Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife. Today's going to be the first part of a three-part series. We're doing a Rich's Vascular Trauma podcast series with Alexis Loria and Alec Kersey. They are both general surgery residents in the DC area. In conjunction with Dr. Nigel Tai and Dr. Todd Rasmussen, they wrote a resident-oriented, high-yield review of vascular trauma for the fourth edition of Rich's Vascular Trauma. They are here today to discuss how these need-to-know tips for residents in a three-part series. So, Alec and Alexis, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Awesome. Thanks for having us here.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So tell us about this book and this section that you added to the book this year.
So the goal is to provide a quick reference for residents who are on call and the do's and don'ts and how to generally approach vascular trauma.
Yeah, definitely geared towards kind of a quick refresher and geared specifically towards residents. The main text of Rich's Vascular Trauma is written by attending level vascular surgeons with far more detail. So our chapter kind of distills the information in the main text of the book to the need to know points for the resident level. And then within the text, each of the sections we discuss will refer to back to the chapter in the book where the reader can review more concepts.
Perfect. Yeah. And if anyone wants more information, you know, regarding these topics, we actually go into many of these topics in much more detail in our trauma vascular series that was with Dr. Rasmussen, who's one of the lead editors of the book. So this is sort of the three-part series, small version of the series with Dr. Rasmussen. So tell us a little bit about your guys' intent for this series.
So we're often listening to BTK on our way into work on runs and, you know, as another way to study. So we thought this could be something useful for residents and trainees to be able to learn the topic of vascular trauma in a different context as opposed to just studying from a book.
Yeah, absolutely. We're thinking, you know, you're on your way into a trauma call at somewhere where you expect to see some, you know, heavy vascular trauma. It's a nice breeze to kind of listen through on your way in.
Yeah, absolutely. The more you know, the better prepared you'll be. And so we're going to start off today discussing damage control resuscitation. We're going to discuss identifying the injuries and the workup for them. And then we're also going to dive into temporary vascular shunts and Reboa in today's episode. And then the next two episodes will be a little bit more case-based discussion of specific injuries. So let's jump right into this. What are the critical first steps in damage control resuscitation, and how do you approach a patient with a suspected vascular injury?
So the patient presentation is really going to dictate the initial management. Not every trauma patient presents in the same way. And so there's some key components to consider when dealing with an unstable patient that comes into your trauma bay.
And really, damage control resuscitation starts in the field, and that's with good hemostatic adjuncts if needed and ongoing resuscitation. Again, in that setting, that you would want to be considering permissive hypotension based on that clinical scenario.
So thinking about those things have been done in the field, when the patient arrives into your trauma bay, especially a patient in extremis, you really want to stick to the basics. We reference the CABCs. It's similar to the standard ABC algorithm that everybody uses, but it leads with catastrophic hemorrhage, which is obviously very important in vascular trauma and making sure that's mitigated right away.
Yeah. So good point with the C part of the ABCs. It's definitely a slight variation, but generally the same principles. We're just trying to make sure the tourniquets are in place and preventing catastrophic bleeding out in the field. So for the listeners, as opposed to the classic ATLS ABC teaching, the C ABCs format is taught in the military setting with a focus on the catastrophic bleeding first, mainly for the medics out there in the field.
Right. And the C, or this catastrophic bleeding of this mantra, should be really taken care of in the pre-hospital setting. But when the patient arrives at the trauma bay, you consider that C is really the checkbox of making sure everything's working appropriately to manage any bleeding.
Yeah, absolutely. Many of these hemostatic adjuncts can be jarred or dislodged with transfers, so you don't want to miss a tourniquet failure.
Yeah, and since we're on the topic of tourniquets, I think there's a couple important things to discuss when regarding tourniquets and hemostatic dressings. First of all, it's very important to be familiar with the type of tourniquets and dressings that your local EMTs are using or that are available to you in your trauma bay, and being facile with application and removal.
Yeah, absolutely. You would hate to want to be able to fix it, but it's some commercial tourniquet you haven't seen before and really not know how to use it. And really, if it's not working on arrival, then absolutely fix it. But if it is working, you shouldn't be taking these things down as a patient comes in. You really don't want to touch them. If it's effectively controlling the bleeding, you want to then go through the rest of your ABCs and really only be taking down a tourniquet or a compressive dressing for a very specific imaging, operative, or exam purpose.
Yeah, and this is something definitely to make the team aware of when you're about to take down a tourniquet or something that's controlling potentially a site of major hemorrhage. Definitely having other adjuncts available and ready to reapply can be a life-saving intervention for the patient.
Yeah, absolutely. This should primarily be done in the OR or with multiple hands available to help get hemostasis. And I think to the trainees out there, I think if you just go ask your EMTs and your paramedics, kind of what do they have? You know, what is the stop the bleed course giving out? Just make sure kind of the very basics that people have, they'd be happy to show you, and it really will come in handy one day, I guarantee you. So we've addressed the catastrophic bleeding. Let's skip the A and the B because this is a vascular surgery podcast and a general surgery podcast. So let's dive into the circulation.
So step one here in the circulation is following kind of your classic ATLS, is looking for other sources of hemorrhage, but then gaining large bore IV access. There's a variety of types of access methods, but going with the basics, getting just good IV access so you can start real resuscitation.
And then when thinking about resuscitation, you know, this is really important, is you want to replace blood loss with blood product. And, you know, now really the standard is the 1:1:1. Again, keeping in mind permissive hypotension where appropriate based on the patient's concomitant injuries. And as something that has been frequently confusing to me, technically the 1:1:1 is 6 units of packed red blood cells, 6 units of FFP, and a pack of platelets, which contains 6 units. There's kind of a technical thing to be aware of.
Yeah, and I think it makes it a little easier nowadays because some hospitals are going to whole blood, which is basically, you know, all these things together. And then you don't really have to quite think about the individual components and timing them. So if your institution, you may want to check your institution, maybe using whole blood.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a last thing here is that TXA is something that's being used a lot more. We won't dive too deep into this for this podcast, but just be aware of what your hospital's algorithm is and make sure it's being considered as if it's appropriate at this point in the resuscitation and management.
Yeah, I've definitely seen a resurgence of TXA. So during the initial resuscitation, what other adjuncts or steps should you be thinking of?
So another relatively new adjunct for a patient in extremis during the initial resuscitation is Reboa. You may need this in the very beginning at the catastrophic bleeding or at the end at the circulation C. And then we'll discuss the Reboa in a little more detail later in this episode.
A couple of other things to consider, more of an aside, is, you know, your broad spectrum antibiotics, indoor tetanus when the patient's coming in, especially with a lot of dirty wounds. And then after these interventions that you're going through in the ABCs, making sure that you're circling back after an intervention is done and making sure it's working, making sure that you're seeing the response that you would expect, and nothing else needs to be taken care of.
definitely. And then, you know, a few other minor details, or minor or major, you want to really be cognizant of the coagulopathy in these trauma patients. So use your TEG or your Rotem to monitor that, and continue to monitor physiology with as many variables as you can. So you may want to consider invasive monitoring with an A-line, especially in a setting of a patient you may end up using that line for REBOA later. Be measuring, you know, clinical indicators such as urine output, lab values like lactate. Anything that gives you a good picture of the patient's status is going to help you early on. And then lastly, closed loop communication in a busy loud trauma bay is really important. So make sure you know what everyone in the room has heard you say, and they're repeating that back to you, or kind of closing the loop in terms of instructions and orders. And be aware of what other teams like ortho, neurosurgery, other specialists may need to get done as part of the initial resuscitation and work as a team.
Okay, yeah. So to recap our damage control resuscitation portion, with the C, we make sure we don't have catastrophic bleeding. The tourniquets are in place and doing their job, and we're not touching them until the whole team's on board. We're, you know, of course, doing our A and our B, but then for the C, we're focusing on good IV access. We're getting blood products into the patient. And then we're also considering our other adjuncts, such as REBOA and monitoring hemodynamics and the coagulopathy.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
We've kind of done the damage control, the patient's stable, but we have to identify our injury. So how do you identify an injury in a patient like this?
Again, like everywhere, the approach to this in most trauma workups really depends on the patient's stability and presentation.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. A patient who's coming in extremis, especially with hard signs of vascular injury, they could be going directly to the OR, where your stable patient is going to be getting potentially more focused imaging to determine what exactly is going on.
And at minimum with these patients, you know, even if they're crashing, you really want to try to get a pulse and or a Doppler exam and if possible, basic neurologic exam early on, so you can have an idea if you're concerned about vascular injury or how extensive the injury has been and how much impact it's had on the limb. It really should take seconds to get some basic exam here and not delay your management.
Yeah, and speaking of the specifics of your exam of vascular injury, I know a lot of the time we discuss a classic dogma of hard signs and soft signs of vascular injury. So those should be being looked at and being looked for as potential indicators that you have a vascular injury there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I just want to emphasize the importance of the Doppler exam. Of course, they're going to tell you that, you know, some other service stole the Doppler and they can't find one. But this is critical in determining the management of this patient and also their neurologic exam, whether this limb is salvageable, how long it's been going on, and having a good documentation of this before heading to the OR is critical for both the patient and the surgeon. So, but since you mentioned it, the hard and soft signs, let's cover the hard signs first.
Yeah, absolutely. So the hard signs of vascular injury, you're looking for some pulsatile hemorrhage or some rapid hemorrhage, expanding hematoma, a Bruyer thrill, absent pulses, and an ABI or injured extremity index less than 0.9.
And remember, having a pulse doesn't mean that there is definitively not a vascular injury. So it's not quite that sensitive. The lack of a pulse will tell you something, and you should have a much higher concern that there's a vascular injury going on. But the presence of a pulse doesn't necessarily rule it out.
Yeah, agreed. Discussing ABI here is important because this is a great way to gain more objective information quickly at the bedside. A normal ABI can rule out a vascular injury in a limb that is neurovascularly intact without a hematoma. And so really all you need for this is you need your Doppler probe and you need a blood pressure cuff, and you compare the blood pressure in the arm to the blood pressure at the ankle, and you have your ABI. So this should be done for any patient with extremity injury and concern for vascular injury.
So absolutely. Finishing up with the soft signs, what you're looking for is a history of hemorrhage at the scene, which you'll get that information from the EMTs dropping the patient off. noting an extremity or a neck wound with unexplained hemorrhagic shock in the patient, noting a neurologic deficit in the periphery next to potentially some sort of vessel injury, and then seeing any sort of high-risk injuries that are in proximity to vascular structures.
Yeah. So, you know, we have these hard and soft signs, but what do we really talk about these for? How does this help us guide our management of these patients?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really the bottom line. And it is definitely guidance. It's not always like a clear-cut matter, but in general, a hard sign should prompt you to go directly to the operating room to explore that injury and get control. And a soft sign is someone that needs further workup. You can't just say, oh, it's not, they don't need operative intervention, you know, ignore it. They need further vascular workup, but they don't necessarily need immediate intervention.
Absolutely. I think that's great. So, you know, one thing that's always important when evaluating a patient is the history. So what are some things you're looking for that might give you insight into a possible vascular injury?
A few key things that you need to obtain, especially in a situation that you're moving quickly and getting to the operating room quickly, is knowing the mechanism that occurred. Any interventions that were done in the field, especially those controlling massive hemorrhage, and then any blood loss at the scene, or what they can estimate their blood loss to be at the scene.
Absolutely. And then a really important thing too, if a patient comes in with a tourniquet, you need to know when that was put on. You want to know the ischemic time for that limb, because that really, that starts the clock for the time in which you want to revascularize the limb. So definitely be aware of how long the tourniquets are on.
Absolutely. So now that we've discussed the history and the exam, let's get into some of the workup. What is your approach to imaging these vascular injuries?
Primarily, this is going to be done with a CTA. And there are some important things to think about, especially at the resident level when you're ordering and trying to obtain these images. The first thing is just being very explicit with your comments in your order, or even better, discussing directly with the radiologist what you're looking for based on your exam and history. This can really change what they're doing regarding timing of contrast and making sure you're seeing the appropriate anatomy around the area that you're concerned for injury.
Definitely. And then when you can, you know, work with the other teams, if you're the vascular surgeon, work with the trauma or the general surgeon or the orthopedic surgeon, and try to get all your imaging in one shot. Which leads into our next point is, you know, the patient has to be stable to be sent to the CT scanner, and you really should go with them if you have any concerns, because it's really easy to try to get away with a little bit more imaging for workup, but having a patient crash while in this CT scanner can be really dramatic.
Absolutely. I think those are all great points about optimizing the imaging of these patients and having that conversation to, you know, tell them where you think the injury is. They can do different phases. You know, they can hold a delayed phase out longer to help see some venous injuries and other things like that. And of course, you know, as vascular surgeons, we have angiography available to us, which we have in most of our hybrid rooms and many of the trauma rooms nowadays. You know, the basic management is done with the CTA, and the angiography is a little outside the scope of this discussion. But what is in the scope of this discussion, which I think is the most important takeaway of this entire discussion today, is temporary vascular shunts, what they are and how to use them. So these are important damage control and temporizing measures. When should you consider using a shunt?
So you can consider using a shunt in a few different situations. The first thing to note is a shunt is used to get inline flow to whatever the injured organ or extremity is rapidly. So if you're in a spot where you're going to have operative delays and you can't get to the repair of the artery to get inline flow right away, placing a shunt quickly is something that could be done there. If you're at in a military setting, if you're at a place where you need to evacuate the patient rapidly, putting a shunt in prior to evacuation, or even if you're at a smaller tertiary center, you need to gain control and then get them to a place that has maybe more vascular capability, putting in a shunt there is also very appropriate. And then finally, if you're doing an operative intervention that requiring multiple teams, or ortho needs to fix a fracture, which is common in association with vascular injuries, placing a shunt to maintain flow to the limb while they're doing their X-fix or whatever repair they're doing can be very key.
Yeah, absolutely. And so for our more junior listeners out there, can you tell us a little bit just the basics of what shunts are?
Yeah, so some of the names you'll hear are Sunt, Javit, or Argyle shunts, among a variety of others. And really, it's anything that, like Alex said, can restore inline flow. So if you're in an austere environment and you don't have one of these name brand shunts, you can use something as simple as IV tubing, a pediatric feeding tube, small chest tube, really any tubular structure that fits within that vessel and can be secured safely so it's not going to migrate. And they can be configured in placement in two different positions. So you can place it in line, which is kind of what makes the most sense, I think, to most people, is it directly bridges that defect. But that's more useful for a short segment defect. In a larger defect of the artery, you may do a loop configuration where basically you create a loop with the shunt and either end goes in the proximal or the distal defect of the artery.
Yeah, so this is in essence some basically foreign material or some sort of tubular structure that's bridging the gap in the vessels there. And it doesn't necessarily have to be just the arteries that are shunted. Veins can very much be shunted and are frequently shunted as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I find the looped configurations a little more helpful for if I'm going from above the knee to below the knee, or larger defects and you want to kind of get the shunt out of the way so something can be repaired underneath it. Those are some reasons to think about using a looped shunt. So how long can these shunts stay in place?
Commonly, you'll read, especially in the military literature, about 2 to 5 hours. But really, the scenario is going to dictate the length of time needed. If you can't fix it, you can't fix it. You've got to get the patient to a safe place. So really, the bottom line is that the goal is to remove it as early as is safe, similar to tourniquets and other temporizing measures.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, they stay in as long as they have to, but as short as possible. So let's say you have a patient with an injury to the distal SFA with a small defect, but who requires reduction of a femoral fracture. Walk me through how you'd place a shunt in this patient.
So first things first, following your general principles here, obtaining your proximal and distal control of your injured vascular structure, defining exactly what your injury is. If you need to debride any devitalized tissue in the area quickly, definitely do that. Confirm you have good inflow and outflow in the vessels. So completing a thrombectomy with a Fogarty catheter, if needed, to make sure you have good bleeding and back bleeding from your distal injured artery or vein. Next, you'll place the distal end of the shunt within the vessel, generally 1 to 2 centimeters, and then secure that with a silk. So going around the vessel and tying that down to the shunt, which is placed inside the vessel. Allow back bleeding to occur, which is basically releasing the clamp off of the shunt that you have. And so, bleeding going through the shunt completely. And then plugging that shunt in proximally, securing it with the suture like you did distally. And then finally, you want to make sure you're securing that either those distal ties together or securing that into the wound bed somehow.
And another thing here, in a complicated patient who maybe has a blast injury with some secondary fragmentation injuries, they might have a more distal injury. So when you restore flow to, say, the proximal SFA, you may get distal bleeding. So be cognizant of that. That's definitely, based on the patient's mechanism.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that just one point I like to highlight here is the importance of back bleeding. I guess I didn't quite understand as a junior trainee that there would be back bleeding if the main artery is transected, but there are those collaterals that are filling distally, and that vessel should be back bleeding at you, the distal stump. If it's not, it means there's likely a thrombus in there that you're going to have to use a Fogarty before you put your shunt in place. Otherwise, your shunt is not going to do anything. So making sure back bleeding and vascular is a kind of critical vascular principle. So as we close out shunts, do you guys have any other tips or tricks for using these?
Yeah, I think it's important to always keep in mind that the shunt is a temporizing measure. So placing it and having a plan for your definitive management. So knowing if you're going to take them to the ICU for resuscitation and then back to the OR, or if they're getting evac somewhere. But knowing what's next for that injury is very important when you're placing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And knowing what's there too, because, you know, if you put a shunt in a patient, but you're going to send them to like the local community center and they don't have someone that can perform the reconstruction that patient needs. And, you know, you want to know why you're putting it in and what's going to be done next. And then another thing is just being aware of and prepared for complications. So shunts can dislodge, they can be kinked. You can cause luminal injury with placement. So, you know, putting the shunt within the artery can disrupt the intima and can lead to thrombosis, and/or the shunt itself can thrombose. So you want to know those are potentials and have a plan for managing each one of them.
Yeah, and speaking of thrombosis, that brings up a good point. In the trauma setting with shunts, you do not need to systemically heparinize these patients for shunt placement, something that can come up pretty often when discussing shunts. So just placing the shunt, leaving it, and then coming back for your arterial or venous repair is enough.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you don't have to heparinize, but, you know, if you have a smaller shunt and a more distal vessel, you'll probably have a better chance of it staying open if you are heparinized. Of course, if you have an iliac shunt or some large proximal femoral artery shunt, you probably don't need anticoagulation. But you know, many times the patients are just too sick to even allow the consideration of anticoagulation. So we're going to shift gears to our last topic of today, and we're going to talk about REBOA. So can you tell us what REBOA is and when it is indicated?
So REBOA, or resuscitative endovascular balloon occlusion of the aorta, is used for non-compressible torso hemorrhage. In essence, it's a minimally invasive alternative to a resuscitative thoracotomy. You should not be using this for thoracic trauma or anything above the diaphragm, because it will, in essence, increase bleeding from these injuries.
Yeah, and this is definitely a temporizing measure analogous to aortic cross clamping or other temporizing measures like that. So it allows for transport and or stabilization, transport to the OR, stabilization to the next kind of phase of treatment. So make sure when this is placed that you're immediately thinking of your next steps in surgical management.
Absolutely. So let's say you're the resident on call and a patient rolls in with a stab wound to the abdomen. Their blood pressure is dropping and you're concerned for intra-abdominal bleeding. Walk me through the placement of the REBOA.
So again, maybe for the more junior listeners, but we'll talk through the steps. So first, I gain percutaneous access to the femoral artery using ultrasound guidance. Your approach is about 2 to 3 centimeters below the inguinal ligament. So using the Staudinger technique, I would place a 7 French sheath. That allows placement for the more commonly used wireless REBOA in the ER setting.
Great. And so let's say you're having a hard time getting access percutaneously. What's your next move?
So your next move here would definitely be a cut down. Just walking through those steps, you're going to make a longitudinal incision extending inferiorly from the midpoint between the pubic tubercle and the ASIS. Important that you're using those landmarks and not the inguinal crease, as with obese patients or just other alternate anatomy from trauma, it can be easy to get thrown off there. And then once you cut down on the artery, you're directly visualizing it and then puncturing at that point.
Yeah, this is a frequent vascular surgeon soapbox moment to talk about the anterior superior iliac spine and the pubic tubercle. You want to feel those and you want to mark them, and that's your inguinal ligament, and that is stable no matter how big the patient is. Very commonly, these REBOAs are placed in the SFA or you know, art lines and things like that were meant for the common femoral artery, because people are accessing at the groin crease and not at the inguinal ligament. So make sure you feel these landmarks and go just caudad to them. And that way you'll have a safer puncture site. So how do you know where you want to put the balloon?
So you can estimate the length that you need to insert it by measuring the distance from the access site in the groin to the sternal notch if you're aiming for aortic zone 1, or from the access site to the umbilicus, and that would get you to zone 3.
Yeah, and for intra-abdominal bleeding, you're going to be placing the balloon in zone 1, and for pelvic bleeding or things like that, you're going to be placing it in zone 3. You're not going to be placing the balloon up in zone 2 ever.
And so just for people to get a visualization, you're actually, you know, holding the REBOA outside of the patient and measuring kind of how much of this catheter needs to go in to either reach the sternal notch for a zone 1 or the umbilicus for a zone 3 placement. And you kind of mark that spot, and that's how high you know how to go. When you actually place it in. So
you insert the catheter into zone one, we're thinking there's some aortic injury and abdominal aortic injury. How do you know how much to inflate the balloon?
The first, you know, a question I asked early on is, what do you actually inflate with? You don't want to put air in there because you don't want to have the risk of the balloon rupturing and causing embolus. So you're going to inflate ideally with a contrast and saline mix, and that'll allow the balloon to be seen on a plain film. So if you want to confirm that you're located where you want to be, it's a useful adjunct. And then you're going to inflate the balloon relatively, you know, steadily but slowly until you get a recognizable hemodynamic response. And that would be an increased upper extremity blood pressure or diminished or absent distal pulses. There is some tactile feedback to doing this with the syringe. So if you're feeling resistance, you know, check what's going on in your line and make sure that you're not inflating too much, because that can actually cause aortic wall tension and potentially intimal injury.
Yeah, those are all critical points and take some practice. And that's a good point, is you don't want the first time you're doing this to be on someone that you're trying to save. So make sure you check out this catheter beforehand. So what are some important last steps placing the ROBOA?
So it sounds silly, but making sure the ROBOA is secured to the patient to prevent balloon migration. So it's easy to get lost in the idea that the balloon is up, ready to go, removing the patient, but making sure that's secured, it's very important. And it's also very important, similar to tourniquets, to note the time of the occlusion, because time is of the essence when this balloon goes up.
So let's say you're in the OR, you've done your trauma laparotomy, and you've controlled the bleeding. What should you do as you consider taking down the balloon?
So there's two things you want to be cognizant when you're restoring flow. First off, the hemodynamic impact. So while the balloon is up, it creates a pretty significant cardiac afterload. So you're going to take that away completely, and you may have some pretty significant hemodynamic alterations. And number two is that there's a good risk of ischemia reperfusion injury, given basically the entire time that balloon is up, everything distal to it is ischemic. So when the flow is restored, you want to be aware of those two impacts. You want to deflate the balloon slowly over a few minutes, ideally to kind of allow for a steady kind of resumption of the pressure below. And then also warn your anesthesia colleagues of the potential sequelae, both from a hemodynamic and a biochemical or physiologic standpoint.
Yeah, and as you're taking a balloon down, it doesn't necessarily mean that the balloon has to come out completely. This catheter can remain in place with the balloon deflated for a little while if you're worried about the patient potentially crashing again on you. And similarly along those lines, that the ROBOA isn't necessarily just meant for patients who are immediately crashing in front of you. These can be pre-placed if you're worried about a patient deteriorating rapidly, you know, along your trauma resuscitation or as you're moving into the OR.
Yeah, I think the pre-placement of ROBOA before they actually need the balloon up, I think that is our place to potentially save more patients. I think in the crashing patient that's actively crashing, I mean, this is pretty heroic and may or may not be successful. But in some of these patients that are at higher risk for major bleeding, getting the ROBOA in place beforehand, and if you don't have to use it, that's great. But, you know, something to consider in some of these patients. So let's talk about complications. What should we look out for after ROBOA use?
So some common complications include ischemic injury, especially to lower limb, and visceral ischemia, particularly in this acute kidney injury.
Yeah, and the other thing is to be aware of is access site complications. So, you know, you're putting a 7-French sheath in the femoral artery, you can cause thrombosis around the sheath, and that can exacerbate or lead to lower limb ischemia. So you want to be aware of that.
Yeah, so certainly there are risks of this, and so we don't want to just place these in anyone as there's significant risk. But, you know, call your vascular surgeon early if you do encounter these limb issues or access site complications, and we'll be happy to help. So thank you, guys. I think this was a great initial podcast of one of three, talking about the how to temporize these patients and work them up and place shunts and ROBOA. As far as ROBOA goes, I'm going to put a link in the show notes here that has a video done by one of our colleagues, Michael Vu. So you actually see all the components of it and see how to actually use it yourself. It's on our YouTube channel, and I highly recommend anyone checking that out if that's interested in ROBOA. Okay, thanks, Alexis and Alec. I look forward to covering the next few podcasts with you.
Thanks, looking forward to it.
Until next time, dominate the day.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.